Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 120, where Rowan, Sarah, and Tom are discussing an important work from Institution Theory, Paul DiMaggio and Walter Powell's The Iron Cage Revisited, Institutional Isomorphism and Collective Rationality in Organizations, published in the American Sociological Review in 1983. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So one thing that I would like us to come back to in the progression through the paper is just before they start talking about predictors of isomorphic change, there's a section in the middle that talks about, I quoted it already once, but then I'll draw the long arm. So where they say, despite considerable search for diversity, there is relatively little variation to be selected from. I think if we take that at a second level and look at why do they think there is less diversity? So we'll have a later discussion about whether it's true that there is less diversity, but why do they think there's less diversity? And their argument is that formal education and legitimation arenas, specifically here universities, but universities and professional training institutions, they quote, are important centers for the development of organizational norms among professional managers and their staff. As which we already know from our other episodes about how professions have barriers to entry and they control their progression, they control their levels, they control their certification. So the part that I found super interesting is on the top of 153, where it says that individuals who make it to the top are virtually indistinguishable. I'm going to take beef with that because I've built a research program on trying to distinguish individuals at the top, award winners, from award finalists and high-performing nominees, and taking this non-binary approach to looking at success or looking at outcomes. They then cite March and March, and then they talk about a case example where the candidates for position were so alike in, quote, background and orientation as to make further career advancement random and unpredictable. So I'm going to take issue with that as well, because I don't believe that these decisions in organizations are ever random and unpredictable. And then the rest of this section is talking about the importance of credentials, which we've also talked about in professionalization episodes, and expertise, and breaking it down to the point they come to where that if you get through the gate into the profession and you absorb this socialization, if you happened to, quote, somehow escape the filtering process, then on the job, you will be socialized as well, to the point that you are individually isomorphic. So this was a small section in the middle where I would say it's the closest we get to an individual level of analysis, or describing individuals as also being subject to these forces. And I thought it was super interesting to unpack the sort of fatalism in this summary, that this is where we're going. Doesn't matter how we get there. We're all the same in the end. And even though our research is saying that you really shouldn't be and that we should be valuing these other parts, even if you're different when you come in, the pressures of these 12 hypotheses that we have put together will make you look the same, right? So this is sort of like the Dr. Seuss Nietzsche's that I love so much and use in my research. So I just wanted to bring that up for us here in while we start looking at how to bring this paper out of its specific historical context and problematize that and say, how do we feel about these declarative statements?
The first challenge that I have is that, you know, obviously, because this is a theory paper, we're talking about what is and not so much about what should be. There's a certain challenge of attaching valence to it. Because on the one hand, greater isomorphism in certain conditions or certain contexts can be really important. Like, you would want, if you are traveling around the country or if you are seeking medical attention wherever you are, from whether home or vacation, you would want a similar experience in your medical care. Variation is okay, but there are certain non-negotiables that make people, I would say, trust a place that gives signals that they are providing quality medical care, whatever that is, you know, that gives the legitimacy in the person's eyes. Now, to that extent, one would say that would be good because, and I'm going to start talking about institutional strength, and I'd have to look up the specific resource I'm using, but institutions are strong if they are some way predictable and stable. If you have a strong institution by which the isomorphism, you know, that you can anticipate a similar experience from one place to another, that would be seen as good. There's also kind of like a health component to it, which it's easy to describe in the case of professions, whereby if the institution is in some way serving the client rather than serving itself, that is, the isomorphism is about providing predictability and stability for the client as opposed to making the professional's lives better at the expense of the client, then that would be itself a good thing. So in that case, I would see that there would be goodness in having indistinguishability within the institution or within the profession, which of course is a little bit different than, say, how we also promote ideas of having diversity of perspectives, which if you squash that becomes bad. And that's when the isomorphism turns inward focusing and ceases to provide the best possible service to the client, because a inward focusing profession would become ineffective. It would become maladaptive. It would become all of these things that we would construe as being unhealthy, of being bad, of being self-serving.
Yeah, I think the point you brought up also brings up that distinction we were discussing earlier in part one about what is competitive isomorphism versus institutional isomorphism, where if it's good isomorphism because, let's say, the customer is demanding you want the same healthcare experience in different parts or different branches or whatever, that would be more competitive isomorphism versus the more institutional one, which is more legitimacy driven, doesn't necessarily have a competitive logic to it. So I agree with Sarah that they at this point become a bit too declarative. So the idea that people who make it to the top are virtually indistinguishable and that promotion beyond that point is random, etc. But if I just come back to the original essence of what they're trying to do, is that they're just interested that the people do seem rather alike, even if, let's say, there is variation, they're surprised by how little variation there is, let's say, at the top or in these professions, then it becomes a question of what is considered functional or not. So let me just quote. They say in page 153, to the extent managers and key staff are drawn from the same universities, filtered on a common set of attributes, they will tend to view problems in a similar fashion, see the same policies, procedures, and structures as normatively sanctioned and legitimated, and approach decisions in much the same way. Now, if you're McKinsey and Company, which is famous for being kind of quite isomorphic in the old idea of like a McKinsey person and hiring from the same universities, or to Sarah's other point, even if they hire from different universities, there's strong socialization pressures when you join McKinsey that you become kind of the same way, wear the same kind of suits and make the same kind of slides and present in the same way and view problems in a similar fashion. And this might not be good, again, based on kind of research on diversity of perspectives, etc., where you don't want that level of isomorphism. But then perhaps an even more interesting and complex case is our own field, or let's say social science, where we train people to view problems, again, to quote, view problems in a similar fashion, see the same procedures and structures as sanctioned and legitimate and approach decisions in the same way. And again, then it depends on your view on science and how social science should work and to what extent is it good to have isomorphism versus a more pluralistic approach. I'm not taking a stance on either side, but coming back to Sarah's point, it's not as if, let's say, if you look at just the top 10 schools, these researchers are virtually indistinguishable in how they approach problems, or how you will still find some people doing more positivistic research, some people doing more interpretive research, perhaps even some historians in some of these schools. So there's always some variation, but what is good or bad, it depends on the field as well.
I very quickly looked up my source there. It's Levitsky and Murillo 2009, in which their two factors of institutional strength are enforcement and stability. So stability is in terms of predictability, reliability, whereas enforcement is how well the institution enforces its isomorphism or the common elements of the field. If the institution allows greater variation to the point where it ceases to look like a single field, for example, that would be considered a weak institution. That was where I was getting that from. But in any case, we're thinking about isomorphism, and we're trying to, in some way, I think, separate what it does versus what it is, I suppose, you know, like measuring the isomorphism in terms of how it behaves and whatever. But the personnel makeup, you know, and this kind of gets in the other angle of diversity. To the extent in which an institution or an organizational field selects people to the point where they do become indistinguishable, can obviously be negative if those perspectives become so inflexible that the institution becomes weak. I mean, it would be a strong, interestingly enough, in the definition I just gave, it would be a very, very strong institution, but it would be an unhealthy one because that level of indistinguishability, that level of strength becomes so strong that the maladaptive becomes a vulnerability. So then the question becomes, I suppose, can there be antecedents to that? You know, is there a way to break that so that the institution doesn't collapse on itself or become so isolated from it, isolating itself from everything else?
Well, you'd have to have one of the other pressures, right? So you'd have to have a mimetic pressure. So this is where our colleagues in innovation and science and technology studies would have something to say, right? Is that you would have an innovation, you would do something different that had a degree of success. And then whether they understood it or not, you would have a certain degree of mimicry. So that would be the first way to break this cycle of self-replication in a way, right? So that's what the all of these three forces come down to. And in this case, mimicry is quite a strong one, even if you're not sure. Because, of course, for me, the mimicry force is their description. At the meso level is our status hierarchy, right? Is their discussion about how in times of uncertainty, how do you make decisions? Well, you lean on the heuristic to follow the otherwise high status person to help you until the uncertainty has calmed down and you can get back to your regular decision-making protocols. So there, if you talk about it as status and mimicking higher status others, then it makes total sense of how would you step away from it, right? And I think, if I may, then make the bridge to the last section of the article, which is Implications for Social Theory on page 156. Here, again, a very strong declaration that societies or elites, so it seems, are smart, while organizations are dumb. Societies comprise institutions that mesh together comfortably in the interest of efficiency. Clark, the dominant value system, Parsons, which we've done an episode on, or in the Marxist version, capitalists. And then they go on to talk about the consequences when you're under conditions of bounded rationality, certainty and uncertainty. So there's our link to the middle section on what do you do under uncertainty. I think we should take this section in two bits. I think the first would be to consider what do we think of their proposals for social implications in the historical and academic context of the early 80s.
So I guess before we get to that, I just want to jump in quickly on what you just said, Sarah, about innovation, because that was another little thing that I never caught in my first reading of the paper. But I did find myself asking the question, and perhaps this is related to societal impact as well, asking the question of, okay, in their telling of the story and this idea of isomorphism, where does innovation come from? And they're not interested in necessarily accounting for that, certainly not in this paper. But it was interesting that in that subsection on mimetic isomorphism, so that's page 151, they say, and I quote, "Even innovation can be accounted for by organizational modeling, i.e. by imitation, in the sense," and then they quote another paper where it says, "While there certainly are those organizations, let's say, who consciously innovate, there are those who, in their imperfect attempts to imitate others, unconsciously innovate by unwittingly acquiring some unexpected or unsought unique attributes, which under the prevailing circumstances prove partly responsible for the success." So innovation can come from imperfect imitation. As essentially, while trying to imitate, you do it partially, or you tweak things a little bit, and suddenly you have a newer model or way of doing things, which then gets imitated by others. And so that was an interesting little insight into how it can still fit within isomorphism, because of course you can have serendipity or kind of happy mistakes under the isomorphic, under a strong isomorphic system as well.
Do we quote Bob Ross now? Yeah, that's a great point, Rowan. And when I'm thinking about like innovation, and we've certainly done plenty of episodes on innovation, there's innovation for its own sake, there's innovation that's purposeful, and then there's innovation that is serendipitous. One other thing about an institution that is, you know, perhaps unhealthy is one, like I said, maladaptive, but also kind of their what I'm going to bring in another paper that I'm familiar with, Christine Oliver's Antecedents of Deinstitutionalization. She talks about different ways in which institutions can either break down or make themselves not necessarily vulnerable, but receptive to change, which can include entropic pressures, which is that serendipity. Something in innovation just happens. There's social pressures, which is somewhat of the external coercive, and political pressure, which is somewhat of the internal. So you just kind of see she was bringing in the same three predictors of isomorphic change to also suggest that, well, they can also play into disruption to that isomorphism. But she's devoted a lot of text to inertial pressures. That is how the institutions defend themselves against the potential for disruption. And trying to break those inertial pressures is something that, you know, even for those of us who are clamoring for change, and especially those of us in bureaucratic organizations where isomorphism and inertial pressures can be very, very strong, trying really hard to push against those, to break those inertial pressures and allow for innovation to either to take hold or to not be just isolated to some part of the organization, free from being a potential disruption to the organization as a whole.
I can't speak to that because I'm not familiar with that background, but what I can link it to is, again, in the section on implications on 156, I love the provocation of, "We find it difficult to square the extant literature on organizations with these macro-social views. How can it be that the confused and contentious bumblers that populate the pages of organizational case studies and theories combine to construct the elaborate and well-proportioned social edifice that macro-theorists describe?" I think the reason that that section came to me while you were talking was when you were talking about bureaucracy, which we know on this podcast, listeners, has a neutral attitude. Some love it and are experts in it. We miss you, Pedro. Some are consistently skeptical or counterpoint to it. But I think the description there of the confused and contentious bumblers that populate the pages of case studies is what came to mind when you were talking about how do we get our bureaucratic organizations to improve and why should they and what are the forces at play against them. And so I thought those were connected for me. And they go on to talk about it as a paradox. And I think, Rowan, here is where your part about the relevance of population ecology comes back, because they talk about it as some version of natural selection and the selection mechanisms that weed out less fit organizations. So the idealist would say, in Tom's situation, that the natural selection would be those who don't change and don't turn the Titanic around will eventually, through all 12 of these field and organizational forces, either be forced to change or be left behind.
I think the other thing that they do here is, so they set up, correct, and I didn't go too much into the paradox, so then I wasn't necessarily as kind of on board with the whole setup, but then they go on to say that there's two kinds of explanations. Let's say the question is a simpler one of just why do bumbling organizations persist? They talk about a functionalist explanation, which is more about natural selection, but not always occurring efficiently. So you can think of that as, why do bumbling organizations persist? The answer is market failure. The second account that they bring in from social theory is a more Marxist account, where it's because the power want to kind of, or rather the elite want to hold on to power or perpetuate the system as it is. And so then, if again, the question is, why do bumbling organizations persist? The answer is because people in power want them to, or there's vested interests for them to persist. And then on page 157, they say, and I quote, "We reject neither the natural selection nor the elite control arguments out of hand. Elites do exercise considerable influence over modern life, but we contend that neither of these processes is sufficient to explain the extent to which organizations have become structurally more similar." And so it's a kind of an added explanation to why do bumbling organizations exist. And that is this kind of isomorphism and what I see as being the underlying driver, which is of a lot of this, is kind of the legitimacy aspect or the symbolic realm of it.
Yeah, yeah. And the rest of that paragraph, which goes on to talk about, this enables us to understand the irrationality, the frustration of power, and the lack of innovation that are so commonplace in organizational life. So those three specifically, I think, speak to what Tom was raising with the organizations that he's engaging with.
Yeah. And for me, you know, it's still now how to get the valence into it, because it's one thing, of course, to talk about what is, and we're, you know, and this is all about what is, but what should be. When we consider those things that we are subject to nowadays, in which, you know, you're seeing these institutional forces at work, and we're sort of taking the model and the hypotheses as, I don't want to say a given, but let's just say that we have not argued against them, so we might as well use them as they are. So then the question becomes, what would make things more efficient or effective for both the institutions, let's say the provider side of things, and the client to have a much more productive, efficient, effective, whatever you mean by the performance of the exchange of granting good services, helping the client, versus when things go badly, which is when institutions start to become insular, when clients start to exert coercive forces on an institution to make it do something that the organizations within a field not really need to be doing. You know, I'm talking about things like excessive regulation or legal mandates or other things. Like, I'm going back now to the episode we did with Lauren Edelman, and talking about how organizations mitigate against legal mandates that they don't understand or can't deal with. And, the result is a protective or a responsive system that ends up with institutionalizing something that is completely opposite of what the mandate was seeking.
Yeah, and I do think that is their part of the thrust of this essay or this theoretical piece, is to point out how that's a separate issue from what Max Weber talked about when he talked about the iron cage. And so that's how it kind of comes back full circle, although they don't revisit it as much as they did in the beginning of the article when they talk about Max Weber. But they talk about how, in the case of Max Weber, the iron cage was about how this bureaucracy, it is more efficient. So it's not about the wrong application of the mandate. There's all these good things about modernity, but careful what you wish for. And again, in this article, I haven't read Weber directly, but in this article, they talk about kind of three drivers of Max Weber's version of the iron cage in on the first page of the article. They say competition among capitalist firms in the marketplace leads to this kind of iron cage of increasing efficiency, increasing bureaucracy. Competition among states leads to that as well. Increasing the rulers' need to control their staff and citizenry, again, leads to this more kind of monitoring and keeping track of who's doing what and measuring people based on their inputs to the job at hand, and bourgeois demands for equal protection under the law. Again, from my understanding indirectly of Weber, he just means how... So I heard another kind of blog, or was it a podcast? I forget, describing it as, let's say you go to the DMV now, back in kind of feudal society, if you go... And the DMV is the Department of Motor Vehicles in the US. Again, a very kind of government bureaucratic setup for getting your license and things like that. Back in the day, or it's still true in countries like India, is there's so much inequalities that if you're rich enough, you don't even have to go. You can just send someone to take care of it, give the right bribes, whatever, get your license. What happens with this equal protection is everyone shows up, but everyone is also a number. There's like a necessary, in Weber's view, a necessary dehumanization. I don't think it's theoretically necessary. But point is, all of these four factors of competition among firms, competition among states, need for control and equal protection, let's call that like a due process outcome, all of it drives this efficiency-based iron cage. And then Max Weber's point was that there's a dehumanizing element to the iron cage. There's a very famous quote of his where he says, "We are all becoming specialists without spirit, sensualists without heart." I think what this paper is doing is, and they say it explicitly, they say, "We argue that the causes of bureaucratization and rationalization have changed, and that the new engine is..." They say, "Instead, we contend bureaucratization and other forms of org change occur as the result of processes that make organizations more similar without necessarily making them more efficient." And so, to bring it back all the way to your point, Tom, whereas Max Weber was talking about the iron cage as like, careful what you wish for, it might lead to a kind of unintended consequences, DiMaggio and Powell's view of the iron cage is it might not even be efficient to begin with. It might lead to a whole lot of other consequences, especially once you factor in power and vested power and why certain practices are isomorphic or persistent or not.
Which kind of leads us to the obvious question, is revisiting the revisitation of the iron cage. If we project this now forward to the present day and the alleged information age, to what extent are we seeing a lot of the same isomorphic pressures being applied in new settings? And how is it potentially, you know, helpful, harmful, whatever, for society now? Some of the things that we're seeing falling to isomorphism are things like social media platforms. There is a lot of similarity in the way in which they provide services because the technology changing so rapidly, there is pressure to try to ensure that people have the ability to use the app, which means that we've adopted common features. Just about every social media platform has the same functionality from the user's perspective in some way. There's common ways of presenting it. Each app is a little bit different, but we can point to much more commonality than difference. And I think there's also a lot of isomorphism in terms of how the value of these apps are being measured. We've come to create a culture about likes, impressions, how we measure engagement. And some of it is also stemming from a sense of legitimacy granted to holding a person's attention or holding the user's attention, which becomes a common goal among these platforms of how they measure their performance. Again, not good, not bad. We're not talking valence, but do we not see a lot of these same pressures kind of at play?
Yeah, that's fascinating because we see it at play. We also see the same dynamism that we talked about in part one, where it's as the field matures. So let's say in the early days, you know, Twitter versus Facebook versus Instagram would have had different, more variation in functionality. Whereas now there's a lot of, you know, for example, ever since TikTok, the short form videos, the ability to infinitely scroll through them is the same. You can do it on Instagram, you can do it on Facebook, you can do it on TikTok, you can do it on, I believe the new Twitter, whatever, on X as well. So as this field has kind of matured, if not matured, at least grown over time, you see more isomorphism and certain practices become more dominant. So it's very interesting to pick that example because you definitely see the dynamics of it as well. And then the second thing, like you said, Tom, is it's also becoming more the pressures for legitimacy and isomorphism at almost an individual level. Whereas before, you might have gone to a consultant, consulting firm or a regulator to transfer these practices. Now it's the influencer kind of ecosystem or influencer economy where you are trying to monetize your legitimacy as an influencer by getting people to follow the same dance reels that you or dance moves that you've set up or whatever it is. So there is some sense of, I can't quite put my finger on it, but some sense of kind of isomorphism on steroids or more atomized version of it. The institution is down to almost individuals trying to copy the same viral trends.
But it's also true for business practices. So we were talking about the survival of the fittest theme in the beginning. And then that the idea that best practices would be the ones that survive versus, you know, competitive isomorphism that doesn't have any sub-branches that strongest survive. It's also true in the other direction. So I'm thinking recent developments in basic streaming and video on demand services that now you have to pay to avoid ads. So the basic access plans, instead of the plan being the main option and then you could pay to go up from there, now the race to the bottom with the plans that the basic option has ads and interruptions and device limits and sub-channel access limits, and you can pay to remove the inconvenience that they have imposed to get back to the mid-level, and you can continue to pay to get to the premium version. So on the one hand, you could call those best practices and competitive pressures. I would say that I think that gets back to our discussion on innovation, right? So is that an innovation in a service? Yes. Or a product or a service? Yes. Is it an innovation that will eventually be adopted and become the new standard, right? That's an interesting question. Was it done because of competitive isomorphism? And was everyone else doing it through one of the other institutional isomorphism questions? I find that super interesting. And I feel that we need to answer that soon, either as a field or as they need to, we as an academic field, they as a business field, or as you said, Rowan, the regulator is going to, right? So I can imagine that the American FTC will have something to say about the constant changing of plans, options, and conditions of contract very soon. And if they don't, then I can see the next level being the consumer to lobby the regulator to then step in with that.
Now, what I'd like to do is to use the subscription model as a way of going back to understanding our definition of an organizational field, because DiMaggio and Powell defined it as a set of organizations that are performing very, very similar service. And now we're talking about what do we mean by similar? And you think about social media, and I don't know exactly where the subscription model started, but you start to see that in across software, across cable television, satellite television services, across a whole bunch of other things, even including food, like groceries. You're starting to see a sense of subscriptions for things like grocery bagging and delivering and stuff like that. So where the subscription model is starting to replace the transaction-based model of monetary flow, because it's seen as more efficient, more convenient. I mean, there's all sorts of explanations. Now we really are changing the definition of organizational field, because now we really are outside of one set of organizations and across a much more macro. Yeah.
But I think the consumer sees exactly what you're pointing out and reacts to this. So, for example, we are recording this in autumn 2024, and one of the business practices that consumers are extremely fed up with is dynamic pricing. Never knowing how much your taxi, your hotel is going to cost. And one of the organizations that is outside the field that where dynamic pricing is a best practice, in inverted commas, for the organization is groceries. So there is a discussion about the U.S. grocery store chain Kroger, which is the largest grocery chain by revenue in the United States, that is going to introduce dynamic pricing, and that in some of their wildest models that have been leaked, we have been talking about introducing facial recognition for the consumer standing in front of the item on the shelf for the price in front of them then to change. And so this is definitely outside a field, right? Outside any of these other pressures. I would say let's look at that as an example. So if they said, oh, well, we're responding to pressures of the field. Okay, competitive pressures is a catch-all. Let's just put that on the shelf for a minute because that's not the point of the article. The competitive pressures are everything that's not one of these institutional pressures, right? So then, is that a coercive pressure from political influence and legitimacy? No. In fact, they're about to get their hands slapped by the economics regulators because of this. Is it a mimetic pressure? Is there uncertainty in their consumer interactions? Is there uncertainty in the field that they're following along with? No. Is it a normative pressure associated with professionalization? No. So why have we seen this sort of transposed practice across the fields? And what are the pressures that are leading us to this point that we're talking about in-person grocery shopping being a dynamic pricing experience?
So that's why I would tend to lean towards perhaps it is mimetic. And it's not necessarily copying a practice, but exploiting an idea. Because they're not the first. I mean, dynamic pricing has been floated out as an idea of which is being adopted and operationalized in a place where it hadn't been previously conceived. So I might make an argument that there's a degree of mimetic. Maybe there are gradations that aren't reflected in this article about the extent to which you're copying something. Copying an idea is mimetic in a way, but it manifests differently based on a specific context when introduced into a different organizational field.
So a whole other dimension that's interesting for the world today, and perhaps it was interesting even back then, but they certainly don't bring it up in this paper, is the visibility of the pressure versus the invisibility of the pressure. The reason it's interesting today is because of algorithms, right? So if you want to be top of Google's search results, there is an invisible, at least algorithmic pressure to be a certain way for your website or to have certain words in it or whatever driving it. Or a lot of these also platform-based setups where there can be coercive reasons that Apple decides that we want this level of aesthetic for all apps on the App Store. Well, in that latter case, it's visible, but with algorithms, you can often have invisible pressures that everyone thinks that they're just competitively responding rationally at the individual actor level, i.e. organization or app developer level, but the system is moving towards something just out of kind of algorithmic accident almost.
Well, the question I would have is like, is dynamic pricing actually new? Is it really, it's new for the context in which it's being introduced, which is a culture of where prices really are, no kidding, fixed and posted. Bartering in some parts of the world is a very standard practice. Here, what we're talking about is introducing a rather one-sided bartering.
I think a lot of it comes down to how you define a field as well. So if dynamic pricing is coming from a different field, based on how you define a field in an empirical setting, then in the case of Kroger's, it's an early stage. It's once you see it within the field of in-store groceries, shops, then you can call it an isomorphic practice. There has to be a certain degree of homogeneity, let's say, within the field as defined by perhaps the researcher.
Yeah, thanks. And I guess we're kind of coming on time, and there's so much to think about in terms of how society is adapting, constantly adapting. When we're thinking about the kinds of pressures that organizations are under to get our attention, I mean, to try to make themselves available, viable. Those alone constitute all sort of competitive pressures to try to ensure that they remain viable in some way. And organizations, we're looking at them going in multiple directions. They're trying to take care of the customer. They're trying to take care of the regulators, trying to stay on the right side of legal. They're trying to be good to shareholders. And we can see so many ways in which those three directions, you know, from the organizational level can come into conflict, and that what may be deemed as legitimate and healthy from one regard may be unhealthy and illegitimate to another. And so there's probably some paradoxical tensions that can be explored, which in themselves may produce the seeds of the undoing of an institution, so that if we do find that an institutional practice that has become widely adopted is something that we as a society, or maybe even the organizations themselves, find unsettling, uncomfortable, concerning, then some of these forces that we've been discussing in DiMaggio and Powell and with some of the other articles that we've cited may very well lend themselves to trying to get to changing the direction. Because bureaucracy being thick, we all clamor for streamlining bureaucracy or eliminating, reducing bureaucracy or making things, making our lives easier with less bureaucracy. How do you do that? What are the ways, what are the mechanisms that can help us address those? You know, understanding how isomorphism occurs is a, perhaps a good step towards trying to figure out what right or what better would look like. So that's kind of like my main takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I totally agree with that, where understanding, let's say bringing valence into it of like what good looks like is an interesting next step. And of course, goes without saying, as I said at the outset, that what I enjoy about this paper is for its time, how well situated it was in the conversation and how it's brought a good and an essential language into our toolkit. In fact, even when they're talking about examples of isomorphic pressure, they're all, again, as with any good theory paper, they are, to the extent, like you said, for the time at least, citing other works that have already shown some of these pressures. They cite Rosabeth Moss-Cantor, they cite, we said, Selznick and others. But it's given us this language that has helped us to at least talk about it further and move it further. And I find it very interesting, like we were discussing now, about what kind of new isomorphic pressures arise as technology changes and society changes, and how that can help us, even if not solve or find out an ideal level of homogeneity versus not, at least make sense of homogeneity versus not. The other thing I just wanted to bring up is also the concept of fields is, I think, only become more relevant over time as things have become even more interconnected, and also organizations become much more kind of vast, both geographically and in terms of scope of what they do. And so that's also a valuable contribution. I have a feeling, and this is again speculative, that it would have also come into DiMaggio and Powell's minds because they worked on not just, you know, the private sector corporations. So DiMaggio, one of the papers he cites is him looking at cultural industries and the production of high culture. And so when you're studying the arts, you're automatically thinking about a whole field of creators, designers, galleries, curators, museums, etc. They were also both at Yale at the time, which had a heavy emphasis on kind of nonprofit management, perhaps still does to this day. And so then again, in the nonprofit sector as well, you're much more cognizant of how it's a whole field of actors and not just a large, you know, AT&T or DuPont or what have you. So it's interesting, again, kind of in terms of the intellectual history of the idea, the fact that maybe the kind of work they did gave rise to this emphasis, but it only seems more relevant now than before.
I think my main takeaway is a meta understanding of from reading this paper together. So I've talked on this podcast before about how I did not study sociology at undergraduate because I was intimidated by the quote unquote dead white guy canon, and how some of my colleagues had read Weber in the original German, you know, and Engels. And so I was intimidated out of doing a sociology degree and a sociology thesis because I could not on my own engage with the what was then the canon, the source material. And the same thing is true also at doctoral level. I did not join up with the org theory community because I didn't understand or self-identify as an institutional theorist. So much of the org theory conversation was about institutions, and this paper that we've done today is one of those core canon pieces that you would have studied with your breakfast cereal as a doctoral student, and you should know and you should be able to teach. And I didn't. So for a long time, I didn't identify as an org theorist, and I didn't understand how I could get to grips with institutions the way Tom is. You know, Tom is incredibly au fait with both the classics and current writing in institutions. And I would like to get to that level. I aspire to that. But I didn't read this paper for a long time because I thought that I wouldn't be able to speak to institutions. My work is very meso level. My work is about individuals and their connections. And this was one of those papers that was just quote unquote not for me. But engaging with it here for the podcast and understanding that actually this is foundational to at everything that I already do from other sources, right? And is such a linchpin in the development of the field, capital F, our org theory field, that perhaps with the experience I now have and the benefit of hindsight, I can appreciate it a lot more. And I can see many more avenues for future research. You know, clearly with the 40 years distance that we have, many of those implications for social theory that the authors raise or avenues for future research have been asked and answered. But I would encourage our listeners to try and find those that remain or those that interest them and to push it a little bit further. You too can understand big factors like isomorphism. You too can engage with institutional theory with this as a foundation and to add your own pieces that are equally valuable and informed by your own backgrounds. And thank you, Tom, for the invitation to do that through this channel, through this venue.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.